WPVMLP in Asheville, North Carolina. 103.7 on the dial, heard globally on WPVMFM.org. And on Alexa. Just tell Alexa to play WPVM Radio.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Sunny across the mountains today, high near 52 here in town. Mostly clear tonight, the low around 28. Partly sunny, not too bad on Saturday for Valentine's Day, the high 58. The rain moves in late Saturday night, probably after midnight, a low around 41. Keep the rain gear handy for Sunday with a high of 51. The rain continues into Sunday night with a low of 43. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. Today, my guest is Megan O'Malley. Megan is going to be one of the speakers at TEDx Asheville coming up on March the 20th at Diana Wortham Theater. She has an interesting topic, and I'm glad she's with us today. She's going to be talking about how we get addicted to certainty so we don't need to spend any more time trying to find certainty. Let's go explore it with Megan O'Malley. She starts out by just giving us a bit of an overview of what she's planning to do on the TEDx Asheville stage, and then off we go.
I think I've been training my whole life for this moment in history. I've been living my own lessons, gathering tools, learning in different directions. I think for this moment when system structures, certainty feels like it's crumbling. So what I'm most excited about is I'm at a place where I feel like I have something to offer that will speak to people during this time. My talk is really about our pedestaling and our addiction to certainty and control, and how that's keeping us stuck and not as able to innovate and meet the challenges that are very clearly here on the individual and collective level. So my hope is that I create some sort of ripple that helps that very, very large process of becoming that we're in right now.
So you say certainty and control.
Yeah.
Certainty implies validation. I am certain of a fact because I'm able to validate it. Control also comes into play because control is something that we do very well as human beings.
Oh, yeah.
You and I are controlling this conversation right now. We're controlling our thoughts. We're controlling the way we organize our conversation, the narrative that unfolds. And we have that combination of certainty and control. But addiction, how does one get addicted to certainty and control? And how do you know when you're addicted to it? Or how do you know that you're just using it as you naturally use it as a human being?
Yeah. Ooh, that's a big question I'm so excited to unpack. So the first thing that is really was really helpful for me in my own understanding was knowing that neurologically we are prone to be addicted to control and like grasping onto facts. And typically that certainty comes from orienting to something that's already been, right? Something from the past has been proven, therefore we feel certain about it, whether it's an identity, a belief, science, right? We can look at that. There's nothing inherently wrong, but the culture we live in that's so dopamine heavy gets our brains focused on chasing that next hit of certainty, whether it's just presenting as the identity we know, whether it's getting external validation, whether it's likes and shares or whatever metrics are around. We're steeped in it. I don't know if there's anyone, unless you're living a very non-traditional life, at least in the United States, I can say, who isn't somewhat addicted to that neurologically, right? And it might be people who are, like, I've been very pro-surrender in theory, but my nervous system has been very controlled in ways that I didn't even realize. In fact, writing this talk has illuminated even more ways I have been unknowingly guarding, hiding, controlling, managing the way I show up. So it's been its own initiation to create this talk. And it's been hard because I've seen even more. It's kind of like sweeping out the corners.
Pro-surrender, what does that mean?
I really do believe that if we have our hands tight, we can't receive anything. So there's this balance of, I'm going to be a very intentional person. I just am by nature. That's my agency in action. But there's a level where I just have to let go and lean into something bigger than me. The creative intelligence of the universe, the energy of love, the quantum field. There's a way of getting beyond my limited perceptions, perspectives, and humanity to actually create. And that to me is surrender. And I've seen it play out many times in my life, typically after forced surrender. So I'm trying to choose it.
Wouldn't surrender be similar to just relaxing into the moment and accepting, as they say in recovery programs, what does they say? Accept what you can change, but don't worry about the rest of it. I don't think I have that quite right.
That's the essence, though. Give me the wisdom to know what I can and can't change, I think, is the core idea of it. Yeah.
So wisdom comes up here as well in this conversation. Where does that play a role, and how does wisdom factor in? And the reason I'm asking that is because there's a lot of buzz around, control, give up control. So what about wisdom? Wisdom doesn't seem to have any buzz on it when people talk about it.
Wisdom is inherently integrative and integrated. It's the left meeting the right. It's the you meeting the me. It's the holy both and. There's all this nuance. I mean, there's to be human is to sit with paradox and nuance, right? But the difference between control and agency feels really important to me. Control is rooted in fear. It just is. We are resisting or rejecting or fearing something. So we're reacting to that fear. Agency to me comes from wisdom. Agency comes from I'm present with myself, with each other, with life, with maybe some higher intelligence in the universe. And from there, from that really, I almost see it as like an axis. I'm going to choose where to direct my life force. I'm going to move in the direction of that wisdom, that inner guidance, whatever it might be. There's a million ways we could talk about it, but it's not reactive. I've talked about intuition in my work for a long time, and people often ask, how do you know if it's just your brain or intuition? And I've often said, intuition doesn't have a charge. It doesn't have an emotional charge. You know you're in some sort of reactive pattern, which is human. There's nothing wrong with it, but wisdom I've learned and clean intuition feels like peace, even if it's an inconvenient truth. There's a stillness, there's a softening. It doesn't brace. Intuition doesn't brace. It just knows. There's an isness to it. And I think wisdom, when it lands, often feels like that.
Would it feel like a good meal you have at a really nice restaurant, and at the end of the night, everything was perfect, and you go, I love this?
Sure. I mean, I think I wouldn't typically think about that in terms of wisdom. I think I would think of that in terms of just truth from presence. Just being fully human, I think, is pretty wise.
Well, because I'm thinking of things that harmonize in one's life. So you do something, you're like, okay, the waters are smooth. I've accomplished this. Okay, fine. I'm satisfied with this. So there's a lack of complexity in psychological meanderings when you arrive at a wisdom place or a sovereign place or a place where you simply have a bit of harmony and a bit of payout even. You can see the results of whatever it is that you've done. Again, coming back to the meal, you make a beautiful meal for somebody, you serve it, and there's that moment of just beginning, when the meal begins, you know it's going to be a delightful experience. And it's also very simple because you're interacting amongst each other as well as having the food.
Yeah, and I even as you say that, I connect with this idea of almost like a field of wisdom wrapping that whole scenario. You know, the the people who grew those amazing vegetables that contributed to the perfection of the meal, the person you ran into on the street who reminded you of that thing you haven't cooked in ages. There's wisdom within, and there's just this field of it that we don't tap into enough, in my opinion.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation, moment in history, this yeah. moment in history. How yeah. are you interacting with that? And when you say this moment in history, what do you mean by that? What are you referencing?
I observe where we are in the collective. Seems to me like we're in a bit of a death cycle. We, you know, there has been a lot of building. There has been a lot of orienting to each other in life in a lot of ways, and systems and structures have been built around that. And it seems that those are crumbling, dying, being compromised. And I think in cycles and seasons. And so while it's horrifying to watch the pain and the harm that's happening, on the sort of meta view, it feels to me like this is a necessary death so that we can actually build something of greater service and create in a different way. That's why I talk about imaginal change. We're not going to build with the same Lego blocks that built this world that's now crumbling. We have to think beyond those same blocks. And often it's not going to be just thinking. It's going to be the wisdom that comes through connection and community.
And the world we're talking about is the human world. If you were to ask the world how it feels, it would be like, well, I don't really care. You know, you guys kind of work it out. You're probably not going to last that long anyway, so I'll still be here long after you go. So it's the human world that we're talking about. When you think about the moment in history, do you factor in all of the people in the world, or are you just factoring in what's going on in America?
Is the best way. I will say I'm really clear on what I'm most aware of, and I don't want to speak or pretend to know beyond my awareness. But when I hear different stories from around the world, depending on where it is, I also hear a similar breaking down, even if it looks different. There's a rumble of questioning of the way things have been, I think, that is fairly collective. I wouldn't ever say everywhere, but I don't think it's just America.
I get that impression as well. And I suspect it probably has a lot to do with the information that we're able to receive and put out. And it's moving so fast. What do I do with this? You know, how do I validate it? How do I discuss it? How do I hold myself accountable? The way I do it is conversations like this.
Yep.
I mean, and there's this whole thing now you hear of, I don't know what to believe about what I know. I'd like for you, based on your experience and your examination of the world and the work that you do in coaching and consulting, how do you help people work out what to believe?
I think first and foremost, anyone who's going to work with me is going to need to know that my job is not to create calcified beliefs or to give them that easy out of just know, like, here's your belief. I think the gift is in wrestling with it. I think the gift is in going, I don't know, and building capacity to not know long enough for something to emerge through that deeper, whatever it is, intelligence, wisdom, intuition. There's a capacity to be with not knowing. It's like somebody taking our binky. Neurologically, and it's so unnerving to have that. My belief is that when we can stay with it, rather than just grabbing another belief off the shelf and holding it tight, that's when wisdom comes. It's a very real toolbox to be in that space, because it's really not fun. It's excruciating, in fact, because that means your identity, your connections, your community, your orientation to life is into question, which feels really dangerous internally.
Yes, and I think the idea of what to believe. I've had conversations with people. Well, I just don't know who to believe, so I'm just going to believe myself.
even though I haven't done any research, but it's going to make me feel better to say I believe myself. So I'm going to believe what I believe, even though I don't have a basis for it. So to me, the idea of verification is a very interesting thing. It's almost like a journalistic verification. If I can get the same seven sources to confirm the same thing, then I can safely say, I believe this is true.
Right.
Take, for example, the TEDx Asheville. I believe it's true because I have verified it, that there will be 12 speakers on the TEDx stage. I also believe, because I've verified it because I know Barry Barton, the director of TEDx Asheville, if someone gets sick and is not able to be on the stage, I believe Barry will be okay with that, and you'll have 11 people on the stage and nobody will know the difference. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about verification.
Yeah.
And what one can believe, not so
with
much
facts. Yeah.
Yeah, like where do, and I am thinking more and more about facts these days, because people say, oh, you can't believe any of the facts. Well, you actually can. You know where your keys are if you hang them on a rack when you come in a house. You know where your car is parked. You can verify that because you go out there every day and it's there. How does one have the confidence and the sovereignty to actually say, yes, there is a lot of, I believe, because there are a lot of facts that I know absolutely to be true.
And I think when it's our own realm, like what you just described, through a relationship that is real in your life, through experiences, through your home, that's, I think it's much easier to say, this I believe. But my sense is when people get really swirly about what to believe in the world, it's because there's information very loud coming from sources that no one, they're not being vetted. So it really is this bombardment of different perspectives, perceptions that are all presented as if they are facts, and then marketed very strategically to be compelling. So I think it's important to be curious and to stay open about not just taking things at face value, because there's videos that are AI and who knows if they're real. There's just, it's an age of, I think, a lack of trust in things like those information sources.
Yeah, so now you've given me an idea. Instead of saying, I don't know what to believe, or I don't trust the facts because they're coming at me so fast and I can't vet them, it might be wiser to say, I am not able to verify those facts. So I'm going to let those facts remain unverifiable. Maybe later we can verify them, but I'm not able to physically verify those facts in my life. And that's actually media literacy. You can verify a fact if you go to seven or eight different sources that you trusted over a long period of time, and you see the same thing being discussed in a similar way over seven or eight sources outside of your own circle. You can start to lean into a verification, because what those people are doing in those circles, they're deliberating.
Yeah.
They're talking about it. They're coming to some conclusion, and eventually a conclusion will get drawn. It's still hard to do, but it's just an interesting thing. So speaking of conclusions, I want you to move now into this TEDx Asheville a little bit more, because people are really curious about how to get a TEDx Asheville. Well, not so much a TEDx Asheville talk, but people are curious about how to get a TED talk. And they'll say, yeah, I want to do a TED talk. My idea is the biggest idea I've ever had. I used to be part of the TEDx New York Salon group, and we would hold a TEDx Salon every Friday, and we would show a TEDx video, and then sometimes we would have the TEDx speaker come in and answer questions. So it wasn't really a TED talk. I was surprised at how many people would come to that talk saying, I want a TED talk. I've got something I really need to tell. And sometimes it sounded okay, sometimes not. So tell us about your experience. How are you going about this? Tell us more about why it's important. Keep in mind, other people listening might want to do the same thing. Some thoughts on how they would go about it.
Well, the good bad news is I don't pretend to have a way to hack the TED Talk process or know that you'll be successful, because I applied guess it was 3 or 4 years ago, I applied and got till the last round and then ultimately didn't make it. And then got the urge again this time because I have been in a massive life initiation of rapid growth over the past couple of years. And I had another friend reach out and kind of confirm that. Sometimes I like the nod from the universe to go ahead and make time and space for things. And I showed up this time. The first time I applied, I wanted the TED Talk because I thought I needed it. I thought I needed it to prove something. I wanted to serve, no doubt, but I also felt like I need this for my career, for my whatever. And this time there was none of that energy. It was so fascinating. And it was because I'm a different version of me. I'm a version who can go through this process with such, I want to say presence and humility. And I think it would have been harder for the self a few years ago. So I came in and I just kept telling myself, if I'm meant to serve in this way at this time, I will. If I'm not, it will be made clear. And I just kept showing up for the next part of the process and trying to be as open, authentic, and heart forward as I could. And then, you know, I got the invitation and I was just really, like I said, humbled and grateful. I'm in the company of incredible humans. These other 11 people are incredible, and I get to share this experience with them.
So what are you going to tell us? How are you putting it together? You said you're having a bit of insight into your own personality, verifying the facts, coming up with the right story. Your talk is how long?
I don't know yet. I imagine 10 to 12 minutes. I haven't had that barrier, that boundary put on yet, because I'm on my fifth or sixth draft. I mean, my talk about unhooking from the need to know, be certain, and control a thing is I have been beginning again because it's such a big concept. And I've realized I can facilitate a workshop, I can speak, I can teach, but to embody it through a mix of storytelling, grounded in science, all this big concept in 10 minutes is an art form that I haven't known. So I'm coming at this just as somebody who, quite frankly, has been able to really be good at stuff pretty quickly in my life. And that has been a gift and a curse. Because with this, I want it to be so good and so impactful that every time I get the feedback, like, this isn't clear, this needs to switch, this, I'm like, okay, I thought I knew and I didn't. I begin again. And it's this really uncomfortable process that I simultaneously experience as such a profound gift. Like, I wouldn't be there if it wasn't my time to be refined in this way, to be guided in this way. And it feels like a steep climb. I wrote a book and it was easier than figuring out this TED Talk.
Well, a book is a little easier to deal with because it's a bit more long-winded. The TED Talk.
Well, and there's space and it's teaching. And this is, you know, one of the coaches, Jack, is really challenging me. He's saying, you went to therapist voice there. You got out of your story there. You know, like, just really helping me embody what I am here to say and not just talk about it is calling me into a level of vulnerability and tender service beyond what I've done before. And I've been pretty forthcoming about my feelings in my own personal brand, but this is a next level. And I've said this for years. If I'm going to do a program on a theme, life's going to give me an initiation on that theme in preparation. Like, that's just kind of how my path has worked. I think it works for a lot of other people. So I wanted to talk about unhooking from certainty so that we could be more creative. And life went, great idea, let's do that. So it's this really personalized process for me to really embody it on that stage.
And I'm thinking of creativity, which is something that has, or something that presents a big problem to all humanity. And the problem creativity presents to humanity is there's too much of it.
Too much
creativity? too much creativity. It's too much of it. And you're not supposed to say that, of course, in polite circles. But what I mean is, you're born with such an abundance of creativity because the earth is all about creating whatever is out there. Look at the bees, look at the birds, look at the plants, look at us. You know, we're messy creators. We just make all kinds of craziness going on.
Yeah.
We're talking about organization. We're not talking about creativity. How do you take something that is that massively abundant and organize it?
Yeah.
I mean, if you go to the Yukon and you discover 500 nuggets of the most pure gold in the stream, and then the winter comes and you don't have anything to eat, the gold's not worth anything. Mm-hmm. So what do you do with it? That's what I think we're talking about here.
Yeah. Well, in the conversation about creativity in general, I hope it's a conversation we keep having more, because I think it's been a very narrow understanding. It's been art and creating a creative thing. And my belief is we are inherently creative. We like to think we're somehow separate from or above nature, but we are it. We are part of it. We have this brain structure that likes to dominate things and think we're better and separate, but we have cycles, we have seasons, we have creative evolutions. We aren't meant to be boxed in, whether it's an identity or a role, you know, that I think we are pushing at the edges of those systems and structures that are hindering our human creativity, like how we live, how we relate, all these things. And it's very inconvenient when creativity wants to do its thing, right? For the systems, structures, understandings, beliefs.
It's inconvenient when we try to control it.
Absolutely. In the world we live in, it's, yeah.
Yeah, we're back to the whole control. You know, I've been involved in the creativity conversation for years. I used to do a collaboration with Julia Cameron. She wrote the book called The Artist's Way.
Artist's Way.
You may be familiar with that book. And
yeah,
Julia and I did Artist's Way creativity camps. We did 16 of them in Taos over a 6-year period or so. I mean, but we did a lot of them. So this was back in the 90s when the creativity conversation was just beginning. And I had a lot of interaction with people around their creativity. That's how I came to the conclusion there's too much of it, because everybody kept talking about, what am I going to do next? And I'm like, I don't know what you're going to do next, but you certainly have a lot to work with. So that was my conclusion of all the, you know, Artist's Way work that I did. I mean, I've taught probably 50 12-week courses. I mean, I've done a lot of creativity teaching. And that's the only conclusion I come to. It's like, there's just too much of it. So let's talk about how we're going to organize it. And the organization lies in the simplicity of things, not in the complication of things.
Mm-hmm. And maybe allowing a little bit to be messy, right? I think we want to organize things so much. And to me, the creative process is, there is often a messy part that is essential to, it's like alchemical process. And we culturally just are taught to be so buttoned up and tidy and polished. And that's a lot of what I'm kind of sharing in my talk, that we don't allow ourselves to even be creative with our lives. I have been, you know, two divorces later, multiple careers, different degrees I'm not using. I've had to learn how to see that this was my creative evolution of both myself and my work in the world. And it's messy and it's beautiful.
And now we come back to verification. One thing I can verify in my life and can verify from other people that I've watched, I have never seen a creative effort start out any other way than imaginative and messy.
Yes.
It just doesn't happen.
Yes.
I mean, take the garden, for example. You go out, you have a piece of dirt that's hard and hasn't been worked. You take the shovel and you double dig it until the earth becomes rich. you spend a couple of years putting compost on it, eventually it starts to flourish. And then when you plant the seeds, there's its own natural Fibonacci sequence of organization that comes up within the garden. Suddenly you have this beautiful garden. And then if you go to France, you'll see, you know, the gardens there are very well manicured. They're very well organized. So we forget that we have this natural relationship between imagination and form. And form is what we really are well trained to do. It's one of our greatest assets, to control and make beautiful the things that start out messy.
Yeah. And I think what I sense, one of the many shifts I sense, is we're moving in our human evolution, let's say, creative evolution, from more of a prioritization, focus on an understanding that's strictly rooted in material science, you know, Newtonian, what you can see, what you can touch, what gravity, to a quantum understanding. And that's about our how our thoughts, our intentions, and where we're pointing our presence can literally collapse particles into form. And that feels like that science is going to help us reclaim some of our creative potential and power. And then if we can, you know, bridge those, because the holy both and, right, the form and the quantum magic, I think the innovation that is possible, I like to think it's just mind-blowing what we as humans and creative beings can come up with when we're not restricting the flow.
And as human beings, we naturally tend to be simple, even in our complexity, because we only have a certain range. And then after that, you just fragment out. And you're not, at least for me, I'm not able to do but so much. And then, oh my goodness. So the idea of the quantum reality functioning somewhere out there, I cannot verify that based on what I know. But here's what I can do from a verification point of view, a little adjustment on it. I don't have to verify it, but I love the idea that it could well be true. So I am willing to suspend my disbelief and just say, okay, I'm going to accept that for me as a real possibility. It doesn't have to be true, but if it happens to be, then it's probably good for me. So I'm not going to argue with it. I'll just leave it there as a bit of an awareness rather than a fact.
Yeah. One of the things that I've been really excited about is the work of, I've got her book right here, Lisa Miller. She talks about the awakened brain. And she talks about how building a sense of a spiritual connection of some sort, or a relationship with something beyond, right? And to me, that can be the quantum field, the creative intelligence of all that is. But when we do that, our brain builds, it restructures the brain so that we are more creative, we are more innovative, we are resistant to addictions, mental health issues, like 70-some%. And so for me, I'm not here to tell anybody whether they should or shouldn't believe something, but even entertaining the idea and imagining, using our imagination, which we all have, to go, if that was true, let me sit in that space and wonder. I wonder is one of the mantras that just guides me. When I get tight, I go, okay, I wonder, even with this TED Talk, when I got stuck, I was like, okay, my humanity is gripping. Show me. I wonder what needs to come across my path. And this book came across my path.
Coming back to your TED Talk, I often think of the TED Talk as a long slam poem. Have you ever watched the Poetry Slam? Mm-hmm. I've been involved in the spoken word movement for forever. So I've been storytelling for as long as I can remember. And the slam poems are 3 minutes, highly memorized. Yeah. The poets know exactly what second the word falls on, almost. And so a TED Talk would be 3 slam poems pieced together, like a feature. And the only drawback to the slam poem is that when you slam a poem, the idea is you don't throw the person down on the stage, stomp on your opponent. You connect emotionally to the point where it gives the same enthusiasm that a sports team would give if the sports team won. So you slam it out of the park. And there's performance, there's recitation, there's performativity, there's overacting, there's telling. What approach are you taking when you go on that stage? What are you going to be doing up there? And you said you want it to be good and impactful. Yeah. Is that your goal? I want this to be good and impactful, or do you have other sub objectives that are floating around as well?
Sure, I've got many, many objectives and goals in this if I really sat to unpack it. But I think I want it to be well-crafted enough to have positive impact. I want it to move people in a direction that is of service, like to turn over some rocks within them so that they leave with a perspective larger than what they walked in with. That's my goal. And I've realized from being on the other end of hearing people speak and share is I can talk about it. I can talk about it for days. I could teach about it. But if I can really be in my body and in the deepest presence and share from there, I think that's where the resonance really happens. There's a whole unconscious conversation happening beyond the words. So that's my goal.
So what's your style when you walk out there? Have you worked on that? Are you going to be a public speaker? Are you going to be a storyteller? Are you going to be a performance poet? I know Sarah Kay is a performance poet. She did a piece years ago. It's had 4 million views. Basically, she just walked out and did a slam poem, and but it wasn't a speech. It was more a poetry performance. So, what do you have a category that you're working in right now?
I don't because I've done so many drafts at this point, and I'm, you know, in this co-creative process with Barry and Jack coaching me. But I think my polished self wanted to go out as a professional speaker because I do professional speaking. That's something that's pretty comfortable for me. But I think what I realized in the coaching process is I'm meant to focus mostly on storytelling, which isn't what I have focused on. I was a therapist turned coach. Like you don't share your personal stuff. So I think that's my edge.
Go more. What do you mean when you say you don't share? So this implies you want to share. What are you giving the audience? What do you give them? What is there that you want to have? A good storyteller. I just stand on the stage and talk. I'm not really a storyteller. Like Connie Reagan Blake would be a great storyteller. I've known Connie for years. You may know her. She's a classic. Mm-hmm. She's one of the great queens of storytelling in the early storytelling days. She lives in Asheville. You know, the storyteller walks on the stage and says, "Once upon a time." And yeah, you are transported to somewhere.
Yeah. And I think that's the big puzzle in my brain at this point is how much to lean into storytelling. I also am hoping to work in a short audience experience so they can feel it. I want it to be somehow experiential, and then also sort of zoom out to help them have some understanding of that feeling I just felt. Why did that happen and how can I recreate it? So it's this, but I want them to feel like I'm with them. I'm not above, I'm not beyond, I'm on the path, waiting for the next moment. I realize I'm addicted to control and not letting life create with me. And then how I kind of reset over and over and over again.
Yeah, I've often said on this show when I've had conversations like this, the most important element of a talk, of course, is the audience. Yeah. The storyteller is just a part of the audience. And I like to think of the whole group sitting together in a wool nest, just having an exchange, just talking. And at the end of the time, the audience feels like they were the ones on stage.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's me. And then they give the storyteller all the credit. Oh, thank you.
That's what I want them to feel.
Yeah.
I want them to feel seen. I want them to feel less alone in this particular human challenge.
What's standing in your way of achieving that? Or are you getting close to feeling like you're synchronized with this goal?
I think I'm getting close. I submitted my most recent draft this morning, and we have another in-person practice tomorrow evening. So I'm kind of just waiting for the feedback to hear if that through line runs throughout and if it makes sense. I find that when I'm in the creative process, well, specifically this creative process, when I'm doing a workshop or something, it's easier. I'm so in it that I can't see it. So I need that collaboration to get a different perspective.
So how has it changed from when you started? What are some examples of what's shifted for you that has put you in a place where you feel like you're getting in the chute, or you may indeed already be there?
One, I'm a writer, so there were just too many words. So it was hard to know which ones were the most essential. So it's felt like this process of distilling. And I also realized, I wasn't aware of it consciously, but I had this whole framework of what it means to give a TED Talk based on the ones that I had seen, the Brené Browns, like, okay, you tell a little story, you got a little research, you do this. And I realized I actually wanted people to have an embodied and kind of spiritual experience, not overtly so, but I wanted it to feel that way. That's my essence. That's my brand. That's my way of moving through the world. And this last draft, I think I had just peeled off more layers of shoulds that I didn't even realize were there, so that I can just get cleaner and clearer as far as sharing my heart. And I told you my dog passed away, and that was even a gift to this process, because what I learned through that experience around surrender, control, and all of that, it's so resonant. It's so a fit. So she may even be part of this talk. She's definitely in this draft.
Well done. Tell me about the layers of shoulds.
Oh my gosh.
Which layers of shoulds have you set aside, and why did you choose to jete or to get rid of those?
I think my whole personal growth and spiritual evolution life has been about unhooking from shoulds. In my most recent version, in an early part of the draft, it says, if I had a dollar for every time my mom bragged about how early I was potty trained, I probably would have been the kid who actually had a pony at school. Like all these check boxes of achievements and shoulds, I was so good at. I learned so quickly, and I came from a family that really prioritized that. So I was steeped in the soup of shouldery from birth. And so it's only been through this journey of perspective and, you know, pausing and all the things that I've found on my journey that I can even continue to see them. Because it's like picking a little burr out of my clothing. It's like, oh, there's another one. Oh, I was doing it again. Oh, I didn't even realize, but there, oh, I was performing perfection. Oops. You know, it's, to me, that's it. And it's an ongoing process, because my sense of safety and security came from following the shoulds of life and pleasing and performing for others based on their expectations.
So hanging should out to dry is something that sits in this conversation. Yeah. And yet I am wondering about discernment and should, because there are some things I should do. I should change the oil in my car. I should have a good diet. I should do this or that. So it's a standard adjustment or a standard setting. I should do this. So it's aspirational. That's one kind of should. Then the other kinds of shoulds don't taste so well. You said the soup of shouldery. I'm hoping that will be part of your talk, because that's a terrific title.
I make up words all the time.
The soup of shouldery. I mean, it implies a lot. Discernment also plays a role in should, because we should not, I say it again, we should not toss should out. We must learn how to appropriately use the idea so that it serves us.
Yeah, and I like to be really clear with language around that, because to me, should is something that is outside of me that I never consented to, perhaps. So when I'm thinking about like my diet or how I want to be respectful in my interactions as I move through the public life, I like to say I choose, because that feels like I'm not being told I need to do it. I'm not passive. I'm not reactive to something that is outside of my sovereignty. I'm in my agency, and I'm saying I want this. I value this. This matters to me. Therefore, I'm doing this. And that feels different in my system. That it lands different. And I'm not saying that there aren't shoulds. You know, we should not be shooting each other. Right? Like there's very clear shoulds, but language around agency, I think, is really powerful.
Right. And I'm thinking if one has agency, one can issue a personal should to oneself.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't necessarily have to come from somewhere else.
It still tastes like, for people like me who really self-abandoned in the name of should for a long time, even when I do it to myself, it doesn't feel great. And I can do that. Like I can try and control myself in order to control the chaos of the world if I'm not careful. Surely I need to just eliminate gluten and everything will feel better. There's a trickiness within me that I can speak to around that word that I have to tread carefully with, because I can unknowingly use it. I can kind of weaponize it with myself.
As an audience member, that is an interesting confession. Mm-hmm. I love that, because you are focusing that on you. I'm sitting in the audience. My relationship with should is very different than yours. But for me personally, I use it as a marker. I issue it to myself sometimes, and I don't find it to be a burden. But I am curious about your story around why should is such a burden for you. I really am.
Yeah, I think it was an anchor of guidance that was never actually mine. And I think I was around people who were living from a place of should. So I didn't know that there was a North Star other than that for a long time, but it wasn't taking me on my path. And I mean, in the not like the selfish I want to do what I want way, but in the my creative evolution, the human I came here to be, should took me away from that countless times. And it took people I love that I was growing up around away from that I can really see.
Your main character in your talk is should. That's your character. You are presenting us with a character sketch in 10 minutes of should. Monsieur should.
Monsieur should.
Mademoiselle should. Or, the soup of the shouldery. I'm going to talk about the soup of the shouldery, and my main character is Monsieur should. I mean, to me, and then here's my relationship with Monsieur should or Mr. should or... As you've talked, I've become more and more interested in this. And the reason I'm interested in it is because it's helping me understand my relationship with should.
Mm.
because should is a character for me, but it's not the same character. It just has the same name.
Yeah.
So there are billions of Monsieur Shoulds wandering around. Everybody has one.
Yeah.
And they all have the same name, but they have completely different characteristics, every one of them. That's an intriguing proposition.
Yeah, it sounds like when you talk about it, it's more connected to the energy of commitment.
Yeah.
Almost. Yeah, like I should do that. I commit to that. I'm moving in that direction or something like that.
Yeah, and we're getting close to moving to the direction of the final part of our conversation because the hour is almost past. I have committed to WPVM-FM and to KCEI-FM in Taos and PVM-FM in Nashville to submit a podcast every week on Thursday. Now, if Tuesday rolls around and I don't have a podcast, I'm thinking, Navi, you should get yourself down there to the chair and make that podcast because you've got to hit that deadline. And so I say, okay, I should do it. I guess I better get busy. I go down and do the podcast. Yeah. So that's where should for me becomes a valuable tool.
Yeah.
It's not a guilt thing. It's just that it motivates me. Now, somebody else like you would never use that word should. You might go, I choose to go do the podcast.
I would say should first, and it would feel ugh. And so then I would go, I love this radio show. Of course I want to go do it. And I would have to recalibrate. I would probably, the outcome would be the same. The internal process and language would be different.
So the should in your place starts out as yucky, but it's actually part of the mess. So you transform it into something. So here we are back to should being in the messy part. What do you do with it as it sits there? And how do you organize your shoulds in a way that can be beneficial to you?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just saying that's where I've gone with this conversation. That's an interesting, that's a good idea. If you could get that across. you know, and the thing I like about that idea is in this conversation, I'm able to use these ideas that you've talked about right now. I've already calibrated them into my psychology as we're talking.
Amazing.
That's a pretty good result.
Yeah. And this, I would say, is the creative process. This is two humans coming together to have a conversation, an honest conversation. And there's this emergent something, right?
Yeah, that's what we've done in the last hour. Didn't expect it. You asked, where is it going to go? I couldn't be happier. I hope you feel the same.
I do. It was lovely. I appreciate you meeting me in the depths. That's where I like to play, to toss around and get curious and messy about stuff. So thank you.
I appreciate it, Megan O'Malley. I'm going to say it one more time. Thank you ever so much, Megan O'Malley, for being on Twice 5 Miles Radio.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
And there you go, my friends. Thus concludes my conversation with Megan O'Malley. She'll be on the TEDx Asheville stage March the 20th at the Diana Wortham Theater. I'm looking forward to hearing what Megan has to offer. It's going to be good fun to see how her thinking evolves over the next few weeks to arrive at March the 20th. I gave a TED Talk in 2011. It was TEDx Asheville. And I walked out on the stage and talked all about the imaginative storm and poetry and that sort of thing. It was a reasonably decent talk. But after I finished with it, I regretted the way I approached it. I thought, what would have happened had I just walked out on the stage, a complete blank slate, and spent 12 minutes talking about the specific subject of imagination and poetry? I realize it's a bit foolish to even consider something like that, as you've learned listening to Megan talk about her preparation. I know for sure that Barry Barton has rehearsals, editing the speeches, memorization. By the time the folks walk on the TEDx Asheville stage, everyone will be very well rehearsed in the same way that a theater company rehearses for 6 weeks, sometimes 3 months for a major play. So rehearsal is essential to making it happen. And yet, foolish little old me, I would just like to walk out and attempt to do a TEDx Asheville talk or a TEDx talk somewhere, cold, without any thought at all, on the subject of the day. And the subject of the TEDx Asheville talks that will be given this coming March 20th will be Embrace the Mess. That's the topic. That's the subject. So it's all about, what do you do with the mess? How do you embrace the mess? What do you do with the mess in your life? Is life anything other than mess? That's a good question. Is life just simply one big, fantastic mess that you never, ever figure out, and you're just wallowing along in it, organizing things as you go? I'm not sure, but I have experienced a great deal of that sensibility in my existence here on this earth. I mean, after all, not everything is messy in the way things get messy when the storm comes through and disrupts the entire status quo. And yet, there is a lot of mess out there. I'm not sure what I would do with it. I certainly don't have time to do that here, but I just thought it might be fun to explore that idea a little bit before I say goodbye. I will tell you this, if I had an opportunity to go out for 12 minutes on a stage, cold, with no prep, I would take 10 seconds at least to just be there in silence. I would start from the silence that I created in 10 seconds, or maybe even 15, who knows? But that would be my first strategy. From there, I can't tell you where it would go. But I can tell you this, we have arrived at the end of the show. And on that note, I would like to say thank you ever so much for listening to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Thank you, Walter Parks, for the theme song. WalterParks.com for more on Walter's music. Daveen Dial, thank you for managing WPVM-FM in Asheville. Robin Collier and Mike Tilly, thank you for managing KCEI, Cultural Energy Radio, in Taos, New Mexico. And John, if you're listening and hanging out there at Elevation Cafe in Taos, I'm just saying hello to you. Thank you ever so much for John for sending me an email. I really appreciate it. If any of you would like to send me an email, I'd love to hear from you. Nave@jamesnave.com. That's a good way to do it. Nave is spelled N-A-V-E. And if you'd like to join me on any Saturday morning for our free Writing Salon of the Week gathering, 1 hour, 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Time, jamesnave.com is how you can find the link for that. It's a community gathering. Doors are always open. We'd love to have you. We generate writing and we talk and we just spend an hour in community. It's a wonderful thing to do. I would love to have you join. And on that note, again, thanks so much for spending this time with me. I do hope you come back sometime soon. And until then, I'll catch you on that turnaround somewhere down the line.
Carlos Santana, it sounds like you've always felt that music is a healing force, and you've become more and more out about that to the general public.
I want to grab that part that you just said from the OJs. Music is the healing force of the world. You know, I love music, you know. But there's a part in there which says music is the healing force of the world. See, that's what we need to constantly broadcast in radio. You know, how music, mystical medicine music, heals a twisted, crooked world.
Oh, man.
There it is.
We need the medicine now more than ever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's there. And all we have to do is just turn it up.